really prepared for the Olympic men's figure skating finals tonight. The current world champion is about a half point behind Evgeny Plushenko of Russia, the defending Olympic gold medalist. There's word the Chicago Bulls are trading guard John Salmons to the Milwaukee Bucks for forwards Hakeem Warrick and Joe Alexander. The contracts of both players expire at the end of the season, which could free up salary space for the Bulls to court marquee free agents in the offseason. Fourth-ranked Purdue has tightened the race for first place in the Big Ten with a 60-57 victory at number 9 Ohio State. It puts the Boilermakers at 10-3 in the conference and just behind number 11 Michigan State, which has one more win. Purdue hosts Illinois on Saturday. Tonight, the Illinois women are at Michigan State. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Preservation Emporium, a free public event on February 20th from noon to 4 at the U of I's Spurlock Museum, with preservation advice on family heirlooms from antique quilts to home movies. The keynote address, Preservation in Champaign County, by Bob Swisher, is from 1 to 2.
It's 2:41. People fed up with hearing about an energy crisis talk about going off the grid. In the U.S., the solution is to install solar panels on your roof or put up a wind turbine. But a village in Germany has taken a different approach. In the final part of our three-part series on biofuels in Europe, Sadie Babbitts explains.
The village of Yunda sits between rolling farmland and woods. The first buildings went up more than 1,000 years ago. It looks like a lot of German villages. Narrow streets, terracotta roofs, and a towering church steeple. But talk to anyone here and they'll tell you Yunda is no ordinary town. It's the first community in Germany to be powered and heated by cow manure and grain.
This is the biogas power station on this side.
That's Gerd Poffenholz. He's lived here in Yunda for 20 years. He volunteers to show visitors, like me, the village's bioenergy plant.
This is the wood heating system, and what you don't see is the network who delivers the hot water in the ground.
Poffenholz stands on top of an underground storage tank. The liquid manure in here gets pumped over to a massive green tank. That's the anaerobic digester. There, microorganisms have a heyday eating manure and grains supplied by farmers in Yunda. The bacteria create biogas, which then gets combusted into heat and electricity. It's pretty silent outside the power station, but open the door. That's the sound of 700 kilowatts of power being generated. The electricity gets sent to the public network. It provides this village of 750 people with renewable power. There's an added bonus. Energy that's normally lost while making biogas gets captured and is used to heat water. That hot water gets delivered through a series of underground pipes to heat most of the homes in Yunda. The village's bioenergy plant went live 5 years ago. The price tag? Nearly $8 million. The money came through a government grant and from residents who each ponied up thousands of dollars to join the plant cooperative. The village has also cut its greenhouse gas emissions in half, already meeting targets set by the European Union for 2050.
It shows you what some wise investments and some collective thinking can make happen.
That's Jim McMillan. He researches biofuels at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. He says Yunda has created an attractive model that could work in the northern U.S. and Canada, where people are more remote and winters are long and hard.
It's a good model, but Europe, I mean, they're built out much more than we are, and so they're doing a lot more in-building. Their density of buildings, the size of their square foot of their homes and everything is much more right-sized, and so these solutions are easier to implement there than they are here. I mean, we have a lot of big homes that would require a lot more heat.
Our attitudes are different, too. It took several years to get Yunda's residents to buy into the idea of going off the grid, but now most everyone is on board. Here in the U.S., we're a lot more individualistic. But McMillan still sees a lot of promise in what Yunda accomplished.
So one village is a good example, but we need to apply it across the board.
Other villages in Germany are building bioenergy plants. In the U.S., a few towns are attempting parts of Yunda's efforts. Reynolds, Indiana, replaced the town's vehicle fleet with cars and trucks that run on biofuel. It's now working with a company to turn algae into power. And in Grand Marais, Minnesota, they want to build a central heating system for the town that burns wood chips from the local sawmill. For the Environment Report, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
Michael Burlingame is the author of several highly regarded books on Abraham Lincoln. He's also chair of Lincoln Studies at the University of Illinois Springfield. He talked with Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley about his newest writings, which are compiled in a 2-volume biography called Abraham Lincoln, A Life.
Cradle to Grave, right. It's a rather vanilla title. I was trying to think up something more engaging, but I just couldn't.
Now, this book is at an even 2,000 pages, and one of the reviews I've seen says, though its length may be intimidating to some, Burlingame's narrative is accessible and engaging. Did you know that it was going to be this long of a book?
Well, it is. It is a very intimidating set of books. And where I come from, New England, where I've lived for the past 40 years or so, sports writers and sportscasters regularly refer to something called the Green Monster. And baseball fans will recognize that as an allusion to the left field wall in Fenway Park where the Red Sox play. But I like to think that they're also plugging my book, which is dark green in a slipcase and is pretty monstrous in size. But the easier way to deal with this book, which is very heavy and clumsy and awkward in format, is to get it on Kindle. It's cheaper and it's much easier to read. And if you drop a Kindle on your foot, you don't break it. If you drop my book on your foot, you'll probably have to go to the hospital.
Last year, no doubt, was a big year for you. Well, it was a big year for Springfield, the 200. Well, for the nation. For the nation, it was a big deal. A lot of buzz here in Springfield with the 200th birthday. You know, now that we just went past the 201st birthday, do you anticipate that there are still some angles out there? There's still some perspectives and research that needs to be done on this president. That are we just scratching the surface of this man?
Well, when I first began my first Lincoln book called The Inner World of Abraham Lincoln 25 years ago, began work on it, I had assumed that everything important about Lincoln, that everything he had said, everything that had been said about him had long since been unearthed and published in book or article form. But then when I started to do original research in unpublished sources, I discovered a tremendous amount of new information, which is why I decided to do this big new book. And I was just astounded. And there's still a lot more to be found. For example, the Lincoln Papers Project here in Springfield is fanning out across the country and digging up new Lincoln letters and letters to Lincoln. And I have a couple of projects which I hope will supplement that, words that Lincoln spoke according to Civil War journalists, and words that Lincoln wrote for the local Springfield newspaper under pseudonyms or anonymously, so that there's still a fair amount of new material to be added to the Lincoln database, and that will in turn produce new interpretations, I'm sure.
Your position as the Naomi B. Lynn Distinguished Chair of Lincoln Studies at the University of Illinois Springfield. How do you fit that on a business card? My goodness.
Small point.
But with that new position, you also get to be in the classroom with students. Can you tell me a little bit about the importance of, teaching a new generation Lincoln and how to approach him from an academic standpoint?
Well, one of the exciting things about being here in Springfield and teaching is that you can teach Lincoln in Lincoln sites. I have a Lincoln class, and we've been meeting in the Elijah Isles house in Springfield, which was the home of Lincoln's banker, where he doubtless spent a great deal of time. My class will be meeting in the old state capitol, where Lincoln gave his House Divided speech and served as a legislator, and we'll be meeting in the room where Lincoln's spent time between his election and his inauguration visiting with people and holding conferences. So I'm hopeful that that will be very, very exciting for students, because I had an experience like that when I was teaching at Connecticut College in New London. I taught a course on Eugene O'Neill, the playwright, and he set his great masterpiece, Long Day's Journey Into Night, in the Monte Cristo Cottage in New London. And I taught a course on O'Neill in the room where Long Day's Journey actually took place.
When you look back at Lincoln, when you step back and you say, why is Lincoln still relevant today? Why is he this larger-than-life character? What was it? I guess my question in there somewhere is, what is it about him that makes him such a lasting impression?
Well, of course, the results of the Civil War in abolishing slavery and preserving the Union and vindicating the idea of democracy, of course, are very important historical developments. But even more important than that, I think it's Lincoln's character and personality that endure, that he's such an admirable character. And yet he's very human too. It's a little hard to warm up to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. They're very admirable and important characters in history, but they're not as accessible as Lincoln. Lincoln has a kind of homey quality. And one of the things I discovered in my research is several of Lincoln's off-color jokes, which I can't tell on the air, but there's several of them, and they're in my book, and they're scattered throughout, and they're not indexed, and they're not all clumped together in one spot. So you have to read the whole book to get them.
And humor was important to Lincoln, but would you say, I mean, was he laugh out loud funny if you saw him speaking, or was it kind of you'd chuckle and then maybe later in the day, oh, wow, no, that was funny. I mean, what was his humor like?
Well, it was pretty broad, and and people would just collapse in laughter, clutching their sides and rolling about when he told the story. And apparently it was the manner in which he told the story as well as the story itself. And he laughed louder than anybody, so it was a pretty broad humor.
Do you ever get to turn off Abraham Lincoln?
Not for the foreseeable future. And it's said that lawyers never finish a brief. They just run out of time. And that happened to me with this book. I signed a contract in 1997 to have a book out by 2009. And even so, with all that time, and I was able, thanks to a generous philanthropist, to have 7 uninterrupted years to work on it, I ran out of time. There are manuscript collections that I wanted to investigate in greater depth, or some manuscript collections that I never even got to see. And one of the advantages of the book is that there's an online version, which is posted at the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College, their website. And it is a fuller version. So the 2,000-page version is the condensed version. There's a fuller version online with much more elaborate documentation, footnotes, and it has a lot more material in it. And one of the great advantages of that is that as new information comes to light, I can add it to the text. And as mistakes are discovered, as they're bound to be in a book of that length, they can be corrected. So it's a kind of Wikipedia that I can control. And I doubt that many people are going to read the book on a computer screen, but it will be a valuable word searchable resource for students and scholars in the future.
I'm always curious when someone is a biographer for someone who they have never met and will never get to meet. And I wonder, with all the exposure you have to Abraham Lincoln, do you feel like you know him?
Insofar as he is knowable. But there are aspects of Lincoln's character and personality which I think nobody will be able to know. And his law partner, William Herndon, here in Springfield, said that he was the most shut-mouthed man he ever knew, and that for all his friendliness and accessibility and all that, there was a reserve and dignity which kept people from knowing his innermost being.
Michael Burlingame chairs the Lincoln Studies Program at the U of I Springfield. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley about his latest book, Abraham Lincoln, A Life. Well, imagine an automaker building a minivan that costs only $5,000 and gets more than 40 miles per gallon. General Motors has done it, but it's only available in China and other developing nations. Michigan Radio's Tracy Sambleton has more.
It only takes a couple minutes on the streets of Shanghai before an example of GM's biggest success in China putters by. Last year, GM and its partner, Wuling, sold more than 590,000 Sunshines, a minivan that's popular both in the countryside and big cities. The Sunshine sure puts the Mini in minivan, but it suits 45-year-old Yu Gomin just fine. Yu Gomin works at an electroplating company. He and his nephew, Yu Bin, use their Sunshine to get to work and haul materials. Yu Gomin says the van is roomy, reliable, and the gas mileage is fantastic. Sounds great. Where can I get one? Well, there are a few drawbacks by American standards. Let's start with the Sunshine's little three-cylinder engine.
43 horsepower. I mean, there frankly are some lawn tractors that have more horsepower than that.
Michael Robinette is an auto industry analyst with CSM Worldwide. He agreed to talk about the Sunshine after GM declined. He thinks trying to sell it here would be crazy. He calls the Sunshine a pumpkin on wheels. It has a top speed of about 80 miles an hour. There's a radio. But Americans expect things like entertainment and navigation systems. The biggest drawback is safety. Robinette says there aren't even any seat belts in the back row.
In North America, we are accustomed to at least 6 airbags, driver, passenger, and probably 2 side airbags on each side. That vehicle is not engineered for airbags, so you'd have to re-engineer the entire vehicle for the safety structure that we expect in this market.
In Shanghai, a little van is a lot safer than fighting traffic on a bicycle, but the Sunshine would never pass a U.S. government safety inspection. Once you've gone down that road, the cost starts to skyrocket. I head down to Lula Rich Chevrolet in Plymouth, Michigan, to see if there's anything close to the Sunshine here. There isn't. GM doesn't even make a minivan for the U.S. market. General Manager Ron Chadoin looks quizzical when I describe the Sunshine's horsepower.
Which means to get to top speed, you probably take a wind behind you and a downhill ramp to get there. So our cars will get there by the time you're at the end of the driveway.
Chadoin shows me something that can move both people and cargo. It's a Traverse, an SUV with 6 times the Sunshine's horsepower. The base price is also 6 times more. The Traverse has front and side airbags, anti-lock brakes, stability control, tire pressure monitoring, and other safety features. Inside...
Well, I don't imagine they put leather seats in a $5,000 car.
To be fair to the Sunshine, it has to be pointed out that GM made money off this vehicle last year, and the lifestyles of hundreds of thousands of people in China improved because they could afford to buy it. GM says it will make money in the U.S. too. But the company will have to go about it American style. That means zippy engines, style, crashworthiness, creature comforts, and a higher price. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
Earth and Sky.
Today, we're speaking with a coral scientist from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Dr. Ku'ule Rogers told us that many sea creatures depend on coral. Her work is to assess the health of Hawaii's coral reefs, and she said that because of changes in ocean chemistry, Hawaii's corals are growing less robust.
One of the main things that we found was that there will be a net ecosystem calcification loss. And this means that the reefs will be dissolving.
And dissolving faster, she said, than they can build back up. She said that's partly because carbon dioxide is increasing in the atmosphere, making the oceans warmer and more acidic. She said this makes it difficult for corals to produce the materials they need to build their skeletons, and it makes coral reefs more susceptible to stress and disease.
Well, once ocean acidification occurs, you're going to see more fragile coral skeletons. Some of the more sensitive species of corals will be completely eliminated.
She added that unless drastic measures are taken to curb carbon dioxide emissions, severe damage to coral beds will almost certainly